are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, July 25th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. That's how we do. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Fernando Tomas Aponte, scholar at the strategy at the a fellow at the strategy scholar at the Scholar Strategy Network and a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. We are talking about the uprising in Puerto Rico. The governor resigns, but what happens next? Confronting the colonial order and vulture capital as Puerto Rico celebrates. Governor Rosello resigns, but what comes next? Does the junta board see an opportunity to increase its squeeze on the Puerto Rican people? GOP blocks election security bills within hours of Mueller's testimony. Theatrically lackluster testimony, but did mostly confirm that Donald Trump was up to some sketchiness. Three blasts rock Kabul, killing more than a dozen. Trump vetoes a resolution that would block U.S. sales of weapons to Saudi Arabia. That's right. In the same week that he is lying and smearing Ilhan Omar about Al-Qaeda, the president vetoed a arms package to Saudi Arabia. The Federal Trade Commission has hit Facebook with a $5 billion settlement for invasions of privacy. Some Democrats say it is not enough. Jeffrey Epstein found injured in his cell. Was it a suicide attempt or was it a attack? Iran hints at a ship swap as they have seized in the UK a British tanker, supposedly at the behest of the United States. Boris Johnson is now the UK's prime minister as clown fascism continues its march across the globe. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. How's everybody doing? Let's start with some good news. There was a resignation yesterday, and we're going to get to our guest in a couple of minutes, obviously, and talk about the broader structure of the uprising in Puerto Rico, the colonial structure, and the relationships to the hedge funds that dominate and terrorize Puerto Rico, maybe even also the climate policies that the United States accelerates that threatens Puerto Rico and all of the Caribbean. Anytime you remove a leader like this, this is also a moment of celebration, opportunity, but also of enormous danger. You know, you can remove a figurehead of a corrupt system, and unfortunately, we see many cases where not only does the system replicate itself, but it becomes, in some respects, even worse. That said, this was an incredible uprising of energy from the Puerto Rican people, and Ricardo Roselli, the governor, who was revealed in any number of ways because of leaked telegram messages, resigned yesterday. Let's watch this resignation.
Siento que continuar en esta posición representa una dificultad para que el éxito alcanzado perdure. Luego de escuchar el reclamo, hablar con mi familia, pensar en mis hijos y en oración, he tomado la siguiente decisión.
So that's him, and then let's go to the streets with people celebrating this incredible victory in San Juan.
You can see them watching it on TV.
They're watching it on a screen outside. So there you have it. We'll see what comes next. The real question is, can the next phases of this movement and push take on, again, all of the other systems of colonial structure in place in Puerto Rico? We wanted to just do this throwback clip. Donald Trump's conduct in Puerto Rico has, even for him, been standout disgusting. And again, that's Donald Trump with standout disgusting. But this is also a good moment to also reflect on this Governor Rosello, who's resigned.
Yeah, he made a number of different PR or photo op appearances with Trump. I mean, Mayor Cruz is in this one too, but Rosello was in there a lot with Trump.
Yes, Mayor Cruz definitely represents as a Sanders surrogate and someone who supported the protests. Definitely a very different political profile than the governor. I let's just say it up front. At the time, after Maria, the death estimates were not clear, but it was a horrifically devastating event. I was in Vieques in this past winter, and you can absolutely still see it. So, and now the death toll is in the thousands. So Donald Trump...
What did we say the official death toll was? 2,900?
2,975.
2,975 of people have died because of this. Donald Trump used, and this is right in the wake of the catastrophe, to do an idiot brag and a totally inaccurate one about the death toll with Governor Rosello. And I should say, I mean, Governor Rosello, part of these Telegram messages, in addition to revealing corruption networks, in addition to the relationship between the government and this control board, which is implementing austerity on Puerto Rico on behalf of hedge funders. He also, in addition to any number of sexist, homophobic, and so on comments, made dismissive, belittling, and comments basically about the victims of Hurricane Maria. So it's part and parcel.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't I see that there were also like some machinations in those texts against Mayor Cruz and tried to make Cruz look worse and Trump look better?
I'm not sure about
that. We'll confirm that, yeah.
We'll confirm that. All right, let's watch this clip.
Brock Long has been through a lot. Brock has been unbelievable. Your governor has been who I didn't know. I heard very good things about him. He's not even from my party. And he started right at the beginning appreciating what we did. Right from the beginning, this governor did not play politics. He didn't play it at all. He was saying it like it was, and he was giving us the highest grades. So Congresswoman Jennifer Gonzalez Colon, who I've watched the other day, and she was saying such nice things about all of the people that have worked so hard. I saw those comments, and everybody saw those comments, and we really appreciated it. I also want to thank Linda McMahon, small business. She has done an incredible job, built a great company with her husband, Vince McMahon. We want to thank you, Linda, very much. Mick Mulvaney is here, right there, and Mick is in charge of a thing called budget. Now, I hate to tell you, Puerto Rico, but you've thrown our budget a little out of whack because we've spent a lot of money on Puerto Rico, and that's fine. We've saved a lot of lives. If you look at the...
That's fine.
Most of that money still hasn't been delivered horror. To Puerto Rico.
But if you look at a real catastrophe like Katrina, and you look at the tremendous hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that died. Now, what is your death count as of this moment? 17?
16 certified.
16 people certified. 16 people versus in the thousands. You can be very proud of all of your people, all of our people working together.
As opposed to in the thousands.
As opposed to in the thousands. Most of the money hasn't been dispersed yet, as Brendan pointed out. And also, I'll just add, Puerto Rico has greater poverty rates than Mississippi, as an example, which is the poorest state in the country. and the extractive relationship. The Jones Act means that Puerto Ricans essentially have to pay import taxes on products they make themselves. It's an incredibly obscene relationship, and we're going to get to it with our guest in a couple of minutes, but we did want to celebrate the resignation of Governor Rosello, and we will be right back with Fernando Tormes Aponte on the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Fernando Tormes Aponte. He is at the Scholars Strategy Network and a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. And he's from San Juan, Puerto Rico. He has a recent piece in the Jacobin called Puerto Rico Rises. Fernando, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk first about what happened yesterday. The governor was forced to resign, Governor Rosello. Can you talk a little bit about who he is and maybe also if you could connect it at least to the two main political parties in Puerto Rico that and sort of how those parties work? What are their ideologies? How does it sort of differ, I guess, from what most people sort of think of between sort of center-right or center-left parties, as an example?
Certainly. Governor Ricardo Rosello, or should I say our previous governor, Ricardo Rosello, is the son of Governor Pedro Rosello. And Ricardo Rosello, in a way, was bred for this position. He was given an Ivy League education. He went to a private high school in Puerto Rico and in an exclusive sort of privileged neighborhood. He had kept a somewhat public profile throughout his entire life, where he would always portray himself as an erudite, as someone who, if and when, would take the reins of Puerto Rico, would have a plan for everything, because he was an intellectual. He had a PhD, he had a record of publications, and of course, this was how he portrayed himself in the campaign trail. He ran for the governorship through the Partido Nuevo Progresista, which translates to New Progressive Party. Of course, a lot of folks now criticize this name because many say that there's nothing progressive and nothing new about this party. In fact, under this party, Puerto Ricans have been made to suffer through austerity measures that have been severely cutting social services such as education and healthcare, while the pockets of folks who are in the inner circle of people like Ricardo Rosello have been lining up with government contracts, many of which are now under investigation. On the other side of things is the Popular Democratic Party. And this was the party under which we saw the change of Puerto Rico's status to what we now have, the Estado Libre Asociado, which translates to Freely Associated State. This name many have criticized because, of course, Puerto Rico is not free, it's not necessarily a state, and it's not really the association with the United States is something that is very much problematic. Both parties have, in the face of fiscal crisis, proposed the adoption of austerity measures. Both parties have faced corruption charges. And what we saw with the unrest is outrage and indignation directed at both parties and the political leadership in Puerto Rico more generally.
What did those telegram messages reveal in the reports? And I know like a lot of, you know, stuff that just made people look bad in terms of how they spoke about political opponents, comments about gender and poor people and so on, all these kind of disgusting comments. But did these messages also, in addition to the more sort of salacious stuff, actually point to bribery and corruption networks and relationships with the PROMESA, the control board?
That's correct. This chat was the kind of X-ray that any population would like to have of their government to really reveal the inner workings of their top brass, of their political leadership. Beyond, of course, as you mentioned, these comments against their own supporters and, of course, their opponents and political dissidents, it showed the workings of the leadership of the Ricardo Rosello administration, which included sharing documents and doctoring documents, sharing documents with lobbyists like Elias Sanchez, who many are calling for his arrest and prosecution. Elias Sanchez directed Ricardo Rosello's campaign that led to his election in 2016. He was in this chat in which there were confidential documents discussed. In fact, some of these documents were titled highly confidential. But of course, Elias Sanchez was had access to these documents, and thereby some of these clients benefited from this kind of access. Not only that, the chat reveals that at one point, one of Rosello's top aides, Cristian Sobrino, who comes from similar circles in Puerto Rican society, a privileged private school, and that sort of privileged sector of the population, tells everyone that the Fiscal Control Board, in which he was a government representative of the Ricardo Rosello administration, had sent him, prior to the publication of a document, they had sent him this document for him to quickly review. He shares with everyone in this chat, and he says, we're going to come back to them and tell them that this is inflammatory and we need to strike this. So apparently, they send the document back to folks in the Fiscal Control Board that was ushered in by the PROMESA law. And hours later, it seems like, from reading the chat, this document gets published and they struck out the part that the local government had objected to.
So let's work backwards a little bit. This is kind of the state of play right now. He's been forced to resign. There's this incredible uprising. And then maybe at the end of the conversation, we'll loop back to what might come next and how this momentum could continue in a positive way, hopefully, not a negative one. But take us back at least a little bit to the creation of this control board and how that relates to a really important legal decision in 2016 that sort of solidified what I guess I would certainly call, seems pretty obvious to me, a colonial status for Puerto Rico, and how that relates to this control board and these sort of broader systems of power over Puerto Rico, of which maybe these politicians are almost like subcontractors of.
Definitely. And let me give you a broader historical context.
Please.
Puerto Rico was held up by the United States throughout the Cold War as an example of how capitalism would thrive in the developing world and how capitalism could bring people up. It could bring them up from poverty. And of course, it was a challenge to the Soviet Union, which was holding up Cuba as an example of development. And in order to be able to hold up Puerto Rico as a beacon of hope for using capitalist policies to develop a country, they had to phase in a series of tax incentives through the U.S. tax code. However, opposition began to grow against within the United States against these tax incentives within the tax code. It was known as the 936 section of the tax code. So the Clinton administration decided in the mid-1990s that they would phase out these tax incentives. By the mid-2000s, these had effectively been phased out. And of course, a lot of manufacturing corporations that had headquartered or had started to develop factories in the island almost immediately left the island. Some, of course, have stayed, and it's still an important sector in the island. But this caused a huge problem for Puerto Ricans, particularly an economic problem. A lot of Puerto Ricans were employed in these sectors. Not only that, the government had developed a lot of clientelistic types of social spending, among other kinds of social spending, that was really the result of important labor struggles in the island of Puerto Rico. So this ushers in a time of fiscal crisis, which of course coincides with the 2008 crisis, the global financial crisis. So this becomes a perfect storm for Puerto Rico in financial terms. Puerto Rico, by virtue of being a colony of the United States, does not have access to bankruptcy as other places in the United States do, like, for example, Detroit, which had its own fiscal control board and had access to bankruptcy. In order to have access to bankruptcy, a bipartisan group of legislators in the U.S. Congress were able to pass a bill that is known as PROMESA, which translates, ironically, to promise. What PROMESA did is that PROMESA would form an unelected board of technocrats whose job was to balance the books and to pay folks who were owed money. These included folks that had pension funds that had invested in Puerto Rico bonds. It included hedge funds that had bought this out of pennies of out of a dollar in bulk and were now demanding that they get paid the entire dollar out of that debt, which they, of course, bought for very cheap. So PROMESA is ushered in, and in 2016 and onward, they begin to mandate, and they have the power to do so through PROMESA Act, a series of austerity measures. This includes slashing the higher education budget almost by half over a series of years. It includes reducing dramatically government spending across a subset of areas of spending. And of course, this begins to lay bare the kind of colonial grip that the United States had over Puerto Rico. It's important to note that Puerto Rico, prior to PROMESA, it only really had one last remaining form of autonomy, and it was fiscal autonomy. Puerto Rico had the autonomy to create its own budget, and it's lost that under PROMESA, which can, as they've done already, send the budget back to legislators and the governor and say, sorry, we don't agree with this, cut more. And that's, in fact, what they've had to do. They've also had the power to negotiate directly with folks who are owed money and to develop negotiations and agreements between them without any sort of input from the Puerto Rican population that stands to lose all these social services.
So, and actually, can we just take a really brief detour here? Bernie Sanders voted against PROMESA, is my understanding. I believe Tulsi Gabbard voted for it, even though she's made a whole show of flying out there.
And people did not necessarily receive her with open arms. They do remember that.
Good. That is good to know, because that's some chutzpah. So Sanders voted against. Do we know of how other presidential candidates? I just want to kind of note that, because that is a very important vote.
This is a crushing vote for Puerto Ricans, because it really took away the only form of autonomy that the island still had. Of course, the island was already suffering from a democratic deficit with very little representation in the United States. But this was passed with bipartisan support, overwhelming bipartisan support. And it's important to note that even many Puerto Ricans in the political leadership, the traditional political leadership that Puerto Ricans are now rebelling against, went to Congress and practically begged for this. Chuck Schumer, among others, Pelosi, you know, congressional leadership. So this is very much a bipartisan bill, and there was very much a consensus. The folks like Sanders were the exception to this norm of course, quote unquote, saving Puerto Rico from crisis. And one thing we hear very frequently in Puerto Rico or about Puerto Rico is that in the absence of Puerto Rico, let's say if Puerto Rico were to become an independent republic, that the Puerto Rico would be in crisis. And of course, folks in Puerto Rico who are critical of that discourse have said, well, we're currently in crisis, very much under the United States.
Let's go back to, can we touch on the uprising against military testing in Vieques and use that as a bridge to what we saw in the last week and maybe also a sense of Puerto Rican politics outside of this discredited political class? What is the left movement in Puerto Rico? What does grassroots politics look like there? And how does it connect to the movement in Vieques, and maybe even more historically, a very long-term anti-colonial effort, which even at times had some collaboration with, as an example, Irish revolutionaries seeking their independence. A lot of really interesting analogies between Ireland and Puerto Rico. But what does that, I guess, you know, go in any direction you want, but specifically the left and movements outside of conventional politics and the threat, at least to Vieques and the military?
For a good amount of time, the largest sector of the Puerto Rican left was the pro-independence sector. A lot of these folks were folks who objected to having a relationship to the United States out of anti-imperialist ideals, who rejected U.S. foreign policy, and who have for a long time realized that the United States had never really had a benevolent sort of perspective or policy towards Puerto Rico, and that it was very much a facade that it kept up as a way of propping up Puerto Rico as an example of how capitalism would thrive in times in which they viewed alternatives to that as a threat, such as, for example, Cuba and the Caribbean as well. The pro-independence sector was very large in the island, but it also was heavily repressed, and there were reasons for why it dwindled over time. Among other reasons, of course, there was some internal division. It was also a predominantly relatively privileged Puerto Rican male-led movement of elites, and folks objected to that. And over time, we've seen the Puerto Rican left very much diversify. We've seen the growth of a strong LGBTQ rights and justice movement. We've seen the growth of feminist groups that have had a lot of representation internationally in the world, conferences on women. We've seen the growth of anti-racist efforts for the rights and justice for Afro-Boricuas, Afro-Puerto Ricans, which of course is something that is often suppressed in Puerto Rico, this notion that, yes, there is racial diversity within Puerto Rico, among other sectors of the left. So in Vieques, what we saw was one of the biggest mobilizations in our history, and it was, of course, an example for the world because in this island, folks were able to coordinate. They were able to grow a strong enough movement that kicked out the military from the island of Vieques. It's an island municipality to the east coast of the big island of Puerto Rico. It's important to note that Puerto Rico is an archipelago of islands that includes two island municipalities, which, by the way, are some of the most marginalized communities in the island. And in Vieques, it started with fishermen. It started with folks kayaking, like Tito Kayak. I like to refer to him as the James Bond of environmental activism, because he'll climb whatever tower he has to bring about some awareness about whatever issues Puerto Ricans are currently facing, like he did when he climbed the Statue of Liberty in a very powerful image that said, "Peace for Vieques, Paz para Vieques." In Vieques, we saw politicians coming into the island and doing civil disobedience, people like Luis Gutierrez. We saw civil rights figures who came and got arrested as well. Some even served sentences in the federal prison in the island. And Vieques was our last big moment when Puerto Ricans exerted pressure on a powerful target and managed to get a huge victory. And that's why a lot of folks have been drawing parallels between the current unrest and Vieques, and that is because Puerto Ricans wanted folks to come out in numbers in these protests against Ricardo Rosselló. And they compared this moment to Vieques, and they said, we need to have marches that are as big as Vieques. And a lot of estimates already say that these marches were, in fact, bigger than Vieques. And there have been, there's been more than one march that has had more than 400,000 to 500,000 people, which it's, of course, a huge number, considering that this is an island that has lost a lot of people and currently only has about 3.2 million people. So that's a good amount, and we'll know after the census how much we have now. But there's a mass migration, and in these times of precarity, in these times of struggle with under these austerity measures, for this amount of people to come out in the streets and demand the resignation of Ricardo Rosselló, it was a very powerful moment and surprising moment. And also, one thing that we need to know about these series of mobilizations is that the kinds of mobilizations that we saw in Vieques took years and took a lot of organizational planning and strength and resources to be able to bring out that amount of people to do civil disobedience in Vieques, to do advocacy on civil disobedience in D.C., and to march in the kind of numbers that we saw at that same time. We didn't necessarily see that. We didn't have that amount of time this time around. This happened in 2 weeks, almost, and really organically. But it's important to remember all of these groups that I mentioned that have been coming up and developing within the Puerto Rican left. There is a legacy of struggle. There was a major strike in 2010 against the Luis Fortuño New Progressive Party austerity measures that threatened public higher education, among other sectors. They laid off more than 20,000 people. So people had already been reeling from these austerity measures, and they were upset, and new groups had been formed. And so these groups were able to really inject some energy into these mobilizations through many means. It was surprising the ways in which they did that. And very creative. Folks used cultural work, direct action. They used music, and they called on their celebrities, and every well-known Puerto Rican across the world was called upon to say something and to act. And we saw a lot of Puerto Ricans abroad answering that call.
So, and that's amazing and so positive. What, as we go to what comes next, and I think it's very important to contextualize, obviously, that the structure of the problem here is a colonial relationship with the United States, the structural, which is exemplified now in this PROMESA board, which is administering these this ruthless plan, which if you have any sense of World Bank, IMF plans across the globe, or frankly, I mean, it's not as extreme, but if you are upset, as an example, of what Paul Ryan was trying to do with his political career, which was to, you know, gut the social safety net and savagely increase poverty and hunger and early death in the United States to help redistribute even more money to wealthy people. I mean, this is, you know, it's the Ryan plan times 20 for an island that doesn't even have formal political autonomy, just to really solidify that point. And now, though, where do we go? And I just want to put two examples in mind. Kate Ashraf has a really good piece in The Intercept that came out either last night or this morning, saying that in this sort of period of this instability and uncertainty, the junta board, which is what some people call PROMESA, is seeing an opportunity, particularly in a sort of very inexperienced leader that will be taking the governor's place. And then Juan Gonzalez made this point the other day, I believe, on Democracy Now, that plenty of examples, and Egypt was the example he used, of you have an incredible movement that removes a toxic figurehead and then the system just replicates itself. So not to put a dampener on it, but what do you see as the more kind of strategic possibility here to actually reorient the situation more broadly?
I think this is a very opportune moment for broad social change, as all moments of political crises are. And it's important to note that over the past 2 weeks, when folks were out in the streets, they weren't only chanting Ricky renuncia, Ricardo Rosselló resigned. In fact, one of the most popular chants were Ricky renuncia y llévate a la junta. Ricky renuncia and take the board with you. So there's a long list of targets that folks are already, if you are monitoring social media or if you have been listening to some of the Facebook lives, you have heard that folks are already calling on the person who is expected to be the next governor to resign. They're calling on the leader of the Senate to resign, Tomas Rivera Chatz. They're calling on the president of the lower chamber of the House, Johnny Mendez, to resign. Folks know that this is a problem that is systemic and that solutions have to be crafted accordingly. And this is why today there was a major march at the Puerto Rico financial sector. Today. There wasn't, folks celebrated last night, but it was a short-lived celebration. And I'm sure there will be more celebrations. But nowadays, Puerto Ricans are learning that protests and further protests can be a celebration, as they showed last night when they had a dance party in front of the in Old San Juan, close to the governor's mansion, and it was billed as a militant dance party, and folks are happy. They knew that they would win. During the march, the major march that took place this week, a reporter interviews a man that came from the municipality of Juncos, which is quite a ways away from where the march took place. He's an older gentleman, and she asks, but what happens if he doesn't resign? And he said very confidently, we'll take him out. So we're living in a moment where folks are pretty convinced that things need to change. We're living in a moment where we're all surprised because this is an island that has been traditionally marked by a lot of divisions, and all of a sudden, we were seeing massive amounts of people, which we've never seen before, out on the streets, and people were talking. They were having conversations in public places, things that we haven't seen in years. And I think that the agenda is clear. There is a solid political leadership that's coming from the bottom up of groups like La Colectiva Feminista en Construcción, the environmentalist movement, environmental justice movement specifically. There's been folks coming. There's a coalition of folks that has been formed to audit the debt, because Puerto Ricans argue that this debt was issued illegally, and thereby there are folks who need to pay. There are folks who need to be investigated, and any debt that was issued illegally should not be repaid. One of the chants that was heard in on the ground was, that's not our debt, and we're not going to pay it. So people know that Ricardo Rosselló was just a figurehead here, and that he was just the beginning of what could be a cascade of series of political changes that may take place in the island.
Final question. From the perspective of solidarity in the States, if you, as an example, are engaging in the Democratic primary, I guess, has any candidate, I mean, we talked about the Sanders exception on the Promesa vote. Has any candidate, would you say, has a sort of particular connection to progressive forces on the island? And if you were in a position where, as an example, you're engaging with one of these candidates or campaigns, what would be the most concrete thing to push for in terms of benefiting Puerto Rico and solidarity with left forces on the island?
It's important to take note of the fact that one of the things that was contained in the chat was that at one point, the DNC had adopted a measure in support of Puerto Rican statehood. And the Ricardo Rosselló party is a pro-statehood party. And in the chat, one of the things that they mention is that folks were criticizing Tom Perez for supporting statehood for Puerto Rico, and that's when Ricardo Rosselló said we should defend Tom, and he referred to Melissa Mike-Viverito, who is a political leader in New York, as someone who they should attack, and of course use a series of foul words to refer to her.
She's a former she's a former head of the New York City Council, Melissa Mark-Viverito. Yeah,
exactly. Who had been critical of the DNC's adoption of a measure to support statehood. This is a moment where what we've seen, one of the most common responses in the United States from liberal sectors to the crisis that Puerto Ricans are going through is, this is an outrage, Puerto Ricans should have a presidential vote and should have statehood. Mm-hmm. What that discourse ignores is that a lot of Puerto Ricans do not want statehood. Yes, there's a number of Puerto Ricans who want it, but this is very much an issue that is up for debate. And if you ask me, what would a wise and responsive candidate for office for president in the United States do to support Puerto Ricans? I think it would be to support a deliberative process such as a constitutional assembly whereby Puerto Ricans could sit down and decide for themselves how they want to attack these problems, how do they want to craft solutions, and more importantly, perhaps most importantly, what will Puerto Rico do about the negative effects of its current relationship with the United States? What will be the decolonizing mechanism for Puerto Ricans? And in my opinion, that is up to Puerto Ricans to decide, not political leadership outside of it. So
right.
That may be a measure that a political candidate could endorse, the creation of a constitutional assembly. And there is, in fact, already a proposal for that in the Puerto Rico legislature.
Excellent. Fernando Thomas Aponte at the Scholars Strategy Network and a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. I really appreciate your time, and thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Take care.
You too.
That was really helpful. I've been saying, you know, I do think at the very bare minimum least, it's insane, obviously, that Puerto Rico does not have a statehood option. But I've always said that the decision, obviously, of independence or statehood is obviously a Puerto Rican one. They're the colonial subjects in that dynamic. And something as simple and as direct as a constitutional assembly, brilliant. Folks, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how this show happens, and that's how you get the fun half. Check out Fair Trade Coffee from Just Coffee. Fair Trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. I will say we're going to be ending at about 1:50 today on the fun half, so it's going to be abbreviated. Normally it's like 2:45. When I started on the show, we would end at 1:45.
Well, you'll notice the Myla intro promises 50 minutes, but it has never been 50.
No. It's never been 50. It's always been at least an hour, even when it was like reasonable. Now it's just like at least another hour and 45 minutes. But at any rate, we're going to be ending a little bit, I would actually say, on time today, just to let everybody know.
I think we streamed for about 8 hours yesterday, seven and a half hours.
Yeah, I was doing the calculations when I was walking home yesterday that counting TMBS, I had streamed for 13 of the previous 27 hours.
Jesus Christ. I needed to leave early, and it wasn't like I needed to go like do some very boring paperwork kind of stuff. And then what was funny is I got home at like a little after 3, and I was totally exhausted. And because we did TMBS the night before and had to get in early. And so I laid down and I missed 90% of the intelligence hearing, but watching by the last 10% of the Mueller intelligence hearing, just partially because I was so tired, I found just like hysterical. It's just like Mueller just being like, nope. Okay, refer to the text. Going a little too fast for me. Just thinking of all the kitsch.
It was just this game of three different sides playing of, like, where can we kick this into the not talk about it in public department? I don't know. That's what's so frustrating about the story to me.
Yes, and also so frustrating about 90% of things that are redacted are pure politics and bureaucratic self-licking ice cream cones, and really, like, with the exception of, like, you know, the designs on a warhead, that this stuff should be publicly available in a democracy, unless it's, you know, an actual threat to a human life or a literal sensitive infrastructure. This stuff, and even means and methods, but, like, come on.
And the contradiction between, and I like government investigations like this. I think some of them are just massive cover-ups, but others are interesting. You learn a lot of stuff. But the contradiction between this is for getting the public behind riled up for an impeachment thing or whatever, right? Whatever this is for. This is presumably for some sort of public airing of something, but there's so much that can't be public that what is really the purpose of it?
Right. And also, I mean, just the I'm sorry, but, like, there was always the just embarrassing, you know, SNL resistance kitsch about Mueller as compared to Mueller's record, which is actually a big problem, from Iraq WMD to massive violations of civil liberties. I mean, I'm sorry. I know we're like the lefties that have to say, like, I'm sorry, but I don't think spying on Muslims in a completely indiscriminate way is okay. Promoting the Patriot Act, but sorry, actually kind of a problem. And I didn't think, you know, I didn't expect much from those hearings, but the tonal distinction of the just, like, embarrassing kitsch of, like, let's get De Niro to play him, and Mueller, of him just being like, you know, honestly, what you'd expect. I mean, it was a little disarming because he really did come off as quite old, and that was sort of a thing. But, like, even if he was more kind of like on the ball and didn't ask for repeats all the time, which clearly at a certain point was a tactic to eat up some time, in my opinion. But it's like, what? No, he's not going to sit there and give you a West Wing monologue.
Well, look,
he's not going to say, I can and recommend, but let me tell you something. We must save the Republic.
I mean, come on. Look, I'm not too concerned with the sort of resistance overreaction of it, but the one thing that does do is it made the Democrats so deferential to him in those moments when he, like...
Well, that is the resistance over. I mean, I'm making fun of the schlock, but there is a... That is manifested in a endless massage of how amazing he is, combined with, I won't even use the word impeachment to objectively, like, reaffirm what you're saying in the Escobar exchange.
Well, and that's why the Democrats should have had a tone of, like, of how the Republicans had. Like, you are either going to, we're either going to build trust with us, or we're going to expose you as a political operative here. Not necessarily a partisan one, but one protecting yourself with, you know, by playing both sides to every single, you know, call you could make here.
Which is how this whole thing is played out anyway already, right? In that Republicans are going to continue to push their own narrative through this, and it's on the Democrats to make it look like this is a legitimate operation, get nothing done as a result of it.
And you don't force your narrative by, you know, thanking him for his Vietnam service over and over again. But whatever.
No, you do not. At the end of the day, it's political, and what we mean, and at least what I mean by that, though, is, like,
Pelosi begs to differ. This is about American principles and stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what's great, is that if it was really about politics, which it is, you would just stop, like, you'd stop all the minutia of, like, when you called so-and-so, you could just say, like, hey, the Al Green option, this guy's nuts, and he's a racist.
By the way,
we're going to tie them up with a proceeding.
Before we go any further, I also want to say, and I don't know if this is true, but this is from the... from the YouTube chat, but Kennedy, who moderates the YouTube page for us,
we have an outside moderator.
Yeah, she.
Yeah,
well,
when did this happen?
This happened because somebody was doxing a phone number of a guest we had, and it was, you know, the sort of spam bot thing. So Kennedy, who also does, I think, the TMBS one as well. I've been outsourcing all this to her. But happy birthday, Kennedy. Can we get like a shofar or
something? Yes, we can. Happy birthday. Happy birthday, Kennedy.
Thank you for your service.
Folks, check out TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Become a patron today. We are going to hit, I think, a 2,500 this month. That's our next goal. We're about 13 away. You get a just truly abundant amount of extra content, and content that lasts because it's history-focused, durable, but also extremely entertaining. Patreon.com/TMBS. On Tuesday, Crystal Ball was on. We had an amazing conversation about MSNBC, media bias against Bernie. Joshua Kahn gave us another amazing tactics for organizing lesson. Join today. Matt, what's going on?
Yeah, Literary Hangover. The most recent episode on Rutger Bregman's Utopia for Realists is now thrown into turmoil because Rutger has endorsed Andrew Yang's UBI plan. Although,
wouldn't it be cool if Andrew Yang actually called him and he was just like, now would actually be a good time to totally screw over Lek.
I mean, I got a few messages from people on Twitter saying this completely destroys my episode, but I will say if you listen to it, I think my criticisms of Rutger Bregman were on the political side of things, which is also where it is with Yang. So it's not a huge surprise that this is. I mean, it's very unfortunate. This is why I've grown a mustache. I've been going into hiding. coming up, James Fenimore Cooper's *The Pioneers*, which is a very interesting novel. It's an interesting novel in that there's really no other way to read it besides a sort of Marxist. There's like sort of enclosure stuff. Very explicit. It's bizarre how sort of. It's almost like it was written way before Marx too. It was 1821. Anyway, so that's coming up. Also, speaking of extra content, there's going to be some Matt Twitch stuff going on pretty soon,
shit.
And video game streaming probably on YouTube. So the people on Literary Hangover Patreon page will get the first bite at that. So check that out. That'll be in the next couple weeks.
Kind of worked. All right, folks. We'll see you in the fun half.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiot.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird.
No way!
Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.